Hello, I'm looking for some guy named Southside Johnny Lyons. Do you know him?
Now 202-202.
Oh, he's not available anymore, huh?
He's gone. He's here at 2 o'clock, and then he just blew out of here.
He did. He left, huh?
That's right.
Oh, what are we going to do about that?
He left his mind in San Francisco.
Yeah, I believe. Somehow I believe that. How you doing, John?
I'm doing good.
Good. So are you ready for me to fire some questions at you?
I'm ready for anything.
I wouldn't say that. You don't know me. Want to know anything? Sure.
You can ask me anything.
I played pinball. I played pinball in Asbury Park back when the machines were 5 cents.
Oh, me too.
Those were the days.
You can't find good pinball machines anymore these days.
You know, we have one here that's a 1972 machine. It's called a doozy.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good one. Okay, so I've got a kind of a bevy of questions, and some basically what I do is an independent specialty show in San Francisco. It's not that different from Miami Steve's show, except that it's not as much garage rock. And actually, you could hear doo-wop next to the Ramones, next to the Beatles,
right?
You know, next to New Southside, but it's all like the old days. You know what your buddy Vinny Scalzi used to do on NEWFM?
Right.
It's all by theme.
Theme show.
Yeah, but really strange, odd kind of themes. Not your typical stuff. So you know, kind of made up as we go along. But it's the West Coast version of what Vin does.
Okay, great.
You know, I'm a Jamaica Queens boy, so I remember when things used to be good. So
you actually get to pick your own stuff to play.
I have 100%. Well, I pay for my time. We're going to eventually syndicate it like Miami show, because I had a show out of Boston in the 60s. I should say in the 60s. Boy, I'm getting old. In the 80s that was syndicated. But yeah, I get 100% freedom. And I have San Francisco kind of at my beck and call on that, which is strange in and of itself.
Yeah, that's true, because that was one of the first of the areas that had freeform radio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very, very much so, as a matter of fact. So I'm going to take you back first, and we're going to kind of bop all over the place. But take me back. I mean, people don't even know that. I mean, everybody thinks Stone Pony, you know. But there was this other bar called The Upstage before all that, wasn't there?
That's right. That's where we went to college, we like to say. The Upstage was a two-story place above a Tom McCann shoe store. And the first floor above the shoe store was a coffee shop with a little stage where folk acts, and I used to play country blues and all. And the third floor had built-in speakers and amps and a set of drums, and all you just had to show up and jam, and it was a rock and roll place. And it was open, I guess, about 4 years, 3 or 4 years, and it was open till 5 o'clock in the morning, from 8 o'clock at night till 5 o'clock in the morning. So everybody who actually had a gig would show up after the gig at 2:30. But for those of us who weren't working that night, we'd go over there at 8 and stay till 5. And I mean, we literally would jam all night long. So that was really where we went to school and learned how to play. And we played every type of music we could think of: reggae, blues, R&B. We even tried jazz occasionally. I hate to say.
Oh my God, jazz.
Well, we weren't very good at it.
Yeah, not as many horn sections in jazz, are there?
Yeah, there's plenty of horns, baby.
Exactly. So you're saying by the time you got to the Pony, you guys were just consummate pros.
Well, I don't know about that. I would think that was a real crucible for us, because there were so many people that would come and jam. And you had people like Davey Sanchez, who was this brilliant keyboard player. He would come and he'd want to do Billie Holiday, or I'd want to do Billie Holiday songs. But we would also do every style of music under the sun. And it really taught us to be versatile, and we learned millions of songs. And we learned how to kind of read an audience, too. We were free. Bruce would come in and do original songs, which was really not unheard of, but it was rare at that time. And Steve Van Zandt would come in and play wild rock and roll things. So it was a good place for us to learn how to interact with other musicians, and also how to keep the audience amused.
And this was before anybody was signed to a record company or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. I'm talking about 1967, 68, 69, right around in there.
Wow. Amazing. And people didn't know that kind of thing was going on for a long time after that.
Yeah, we were very lucky in that. And we knew it, too. We realized that we had that golden opportunity to be ourselves. The bars in Asbury Park and all of the rest of New Jersey paid good money for cover bands, but none of us wanted to do that. I mean, we were jealous of the money they were making, but we didn't want to go and sing cover songs all night long. So this one club, the Upstage Club, although it didn't pay any money, would let us play whatever we wanted to play, and that's where we learned to do that.
Right, a great, great training ground. They don't exist anymore, unfortunately. So, the Jukes, were you guys friends? I read that there were somewhere that there were remnants of 48 different bands that found their way into the Jukes.
I wouldn't doubt that. We've had over 100 people, I think, go through this band.
You guys, you're not a band. You're a fraternity, for crying out loud.
It's an employment agency.
Exactly.
It really was kind of a whim. I took over a band that was playing little tiny clubs, and I was a little bit more ambitious, so we learned a few more songs, and this was a real hippie band. The bass player wouldn't stop playing at the end of the song, and I could never get more than two words out of the guitar player, although he was a brilliant guitar player. But at one point or another, I started adding musicians. I added Kevin Cavanaugh on keyboard, and then Steve Van Zandt, who was working at Jackhammer on the New Jersey Turnpike. I said, Steve, you got to cut that out. You got to play in my band. And, you know, just to give him a job to get him from stop ruining his bands with the Jackhammer. And that's what became the Jukes. We started adding horns because both Steven and I wanted to have horns in the band. And since that time, a lot of guys have come and gone because we have been playing for over 25 years. And we used to be on the road 11 months out of the year, and not everybody can take that, especially if they want to have, like, you know, a home life.
Home life? What, rock and roll and a home life? Come on.
Well, as you get older, you kind of say, gee, maybe I should actually spend some time with my wife and kids.
What a concept. Believe me, I know. I have a 20-month-old, and as I go off to do radio shows and interviews and all that other stuff, my wife is kind of like, so what is it? I'm like, it's a passion. And, you know, my daughter is already into the music, so it doesn't matter. So from moment one, you were kind of doing this incredible mix. I mean, obviously, you know, Miami, Steve, and Bruce's songs, but you're also doing Solomon Burke and Steve Cropper and Ray Charles. This wasn't easily categorical, you know, or easy to categorize rock and roll music at that time by any stretch, or at any time since when you come right down to it.
No, and we like to do rock and roll things, too. I mean, we like to turn the guitars up and scream. And I mean, I was a big fan of punk music. I remember seeing Iggy Stooge when he came to Asbury Park and thinking, wow, this is great, because he was even more free on stage than I was. And we used to go up to see the Ramones and Tough Darts and the Shirts from Brooklyn.
You guys were at CBGB's, obviously.
Yeah, CBGB's and all the rest of the clubs that were up there. And it was really a kind of a rejuvenation of the rock and roll feel, which I always loved. You know, the freedom to just go up and do what you want to do. We still do that with the Jukes. I mean, we don't really have a set list. And if we want to do a song we've never rehearsed, we'll do that too. And that's all the stuff that I learned from those times, that you just have to be free on stage to lose your mind. I mean, that's the great opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
So, with the Jukes, for me, I mean, even though we have horns, there's times when we go out and, you know, the horns don't play on a couple of songs or whatever we want to do. And I really like that. So it is hard to categorize. It is R&B based, but I love blues, of course, obviously. And I love rock and roll. And I want to play it all.
Everybody, so many people get confused that the South Side came from South Jersey and obviously not from the South Side of Chicago and Bad Bad Leroy Brown.
Well, I was nicknamed Southside when Bruce came back from California and he didn't have a dime to his name. And a guy named Fisher had this place called not the Hullabaloo Club, Sunshine Inn, which is this converted garage. And Bruce was pretty much a name in Asbury Park at that time. And he wanted Bruce to play his place. He had seen Bruce play, but Bruce didn't want to play there. So finally he offered him a bunch of money to play there, $500 or something like that. So Bruce said, great. And he put together a band, and it just started to expand. And finally, there were two drummers, four guitar players, two bass players, baton twirlers, a Monopoly game, the Jukes Chorus, which is all the musicians we couldn't fit with instruments on stage. And it ended up to be like 25 people on stage. And everybody had to have a nickname, and because I like Chicago blues, which was played on the South Side of Chicago, I became Southside Johnny. Much to my dismay, in later years, I couldn't get rid of it. So it's like a nickname, like, you know, a tattoo.
Well, at least you weren't called Bozo or something, you know?
What's that?
Bozo would have been worse.
I don't know.
Bozo Johnny Lyons, you know?
No, I think they call me that anyway.
Me too. Just give me a sense, because you keep talking about how free it was, and yet there was, even back then, there was, you know, corporate rock and all of that, and you guys managed to escape it. But, you know, who played the same kind of gigs as you that you still know and never really made it, so to speak?
You mean what bands back then?
Yeah, I mean, there was so many bands trying to do what you did, and, you know, you guys, you know, and again, definitions of making it, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, you know, whether top 40 is making it or not is not necessarily relevant to you guys, that's for sure.
I think all of the bands back then got the idea. There was a band called Odyssey that played like Paul Butterfield-style blues, but they were certainly capable of going into just about anything. They were really good musicians. That's the band Kevin came from. And then there was a band called Sonny Jim, and they did wild things, Frank Zappa-inspired things. But we were all play on the same bills if there were outdoor shows, in a park or something like that. And the audience they weren't so hidebound that they wanted to hear the same thing over and over again. All the different bands got a good reception if they played well and they were sincere about what they were playing. And I think that's one of the great gifts to all of us from the New Jersey area, is that the audiences were as open as we were to hearing different things. And it gave us the freedom to experiment and find out what we liked and what we didn't like. They didn't dictate to us that, oh, no, we want to hear that song, we don't want to hear this song.
So I'm going to kind of skip around a little bit, because I am, in addition to the regular show, which I'm going to use some of this on, because I do play your stuff quite a bit. What makes a band a bar band? And why do some bands, because, I mean, you still play a lot of bars, but you also, I mean, I saw you guys out here at Montalvo, which is a much bigger, you know, bigger venue. So you've made it beyond the bar band, but yet the Jukes at heart, there's no question that you're a bar band. What makes a bar band?
I think it's the ability to get people to dance is one of the main things. But, you know, there's no aloofness to a bar band. I mean, everybody's welcome to join in. We have fun on stage, and we expect the audience to have fun, too. And, you know, we don't want to be looked at as gods or any of that rock and roll crap. I think a real bar band is a band that gets down and sweats and dances and has the audience sing along with them, and it's all one, if you know what I mean. There's not a lot of barriers between the audience and the band. It's not like we're the stars and you're the audience. We're all just having a good time together. And also, you got to play the kind of music that works in those kind of milieus too, R&B and rock and roll and blues. And the kind of, it's really people music. It's music about people. It is not some esoteric exercise, and it is not this great artistic endeavor. It's music about people and what they go through.
I wasn't going to ask this, but it just, when you were talking about the difference, it just hit me in a funny way. Did you ever play one of those, in Animal House where they played behind the cage so they were protected from the bottles and stuff?
We played a place like that in Texas, but they didn't put the cage up.
Oh, no.
But they had it, but it was our audience. I mean, it was like 500 people who had come to see us. And we were there, and I said, oh, man, this is one of those chicken wire bars. And I was, like, thrilled, you know, and I thought, this will be great. And I asked the owner later. He said, no, these are your people. I don't have to protect you from them.
But they had the chicken wire ready to rock for if it wasn't you or somebody else, huh?
Yeah, they only use that. They say, he said, we only use that stuff if the band stinks. And the audience responds accordingly, so.
Oh, geez. Can you imagine? So, would you say that a lot of it was your music too? I mean, I don't want to go home or this time it's real. These are ultimate bar band songs, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I don't know about ultimate, but there's certainly songs. I mean, the setting of some of those songs, I Don't Want to Go Home, takes place in a bar, and that's where we learned our craft, and we still play a lot of bars. Christ, I always think of myself as growing up in a bar, basically.
not a bad thing, which is a great kind of segue. I mean, back in the day, Asbury Park wasn't exactly paradise by any stretch. So do you think the atmosphere bred the love for Specter and Stax and, you know, doo-wop, kind of the music of the middle or not even middle class?
Well, I take exception to your...
I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going
to... Asbury Park was paradise. I mean, it had pinball machines and girls and bars and music and boardwalk and the ocean. It was just the greatest for a teenager. It's a lot worse now, let's face it.
Yeah, no question about it, because back then the problem was not drugs and things like that.
Yeah, but it is a blue... New Jersey still... I mean, there are certainly very wealthy areas like Bedminster and Short Hills, but New Jersey has a reputation of being more a blue-collar state, and I think with a lot of pride, just like Pittsburgh and like that, it's not a real she place where people sit there and are too cool to get involved. The people who like music in New Jersey really like it and are willing to say, yeah, I really like that, and join in. And of course, that's the kind of music that we make, so it was a pretty good fit.
Yep, no, and it makes sense. And by the way, I think it was paradise. I know that when I was 13, I took the bus down to Asbury Park from Rockland County, where I lived at the time, and played pinball and lived the whole moment, and it was great.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great place to be a teenager. I mean, and it wasn't, like you say, there were certainly drugs. I certainly found my share of whatever, but it wasn't really hardcore, dangerous drug stuff. And it was mostly fairly benign. I mean, the cops would be nasty to you, and you'd get, you know, thrown in jail for not carrying your ID or something like that. But then you'd be out in a few hours. There was all those intimidation tactics. But it wasn't really... To me, it was a place that you could go to and be a wild child. And then when you got in trouble, you could always retreat back to Ocean Grove where I lived.
some place safe.
I had the best of both worlds that way.
Not a bad thing. So, silly question, but a 10-piece band playing little bars, what do you make, $6?
Yeah, it's not one of those money-making things, that's for sure. I mean, there were years when I lost money, but it's what you want, and, you know, you can trade what you want for a big house or a fancy car, but I don't want a big house or a fancy car. I want a horn section. So that's
the that, you know, you want that on your tombstone?
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't. That's really good.
It would have cost me less to be a junkie. My addiction's a lot more expensive than heroin.
indeed. So again, skipping around, the Fever. They never released the Fever. I mean, it was certainly one of your iconic songs. Never released it as a single. Could they not cut it to 3 minutes for WABC? Was that the problem there?
I have no idea. I was never involved in any of that process. As far as I was concerned with the record companies, I made the records, and whatever they did, they did.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I've talked to a lot of people recently about the record company, and obviously you know, you've left the majors since, but you were on a major, and so you were, if you were gigging and you were happy, you were more than willing to let them kind of be responsible for your destiny as to what they released?
Well, it was like this. I didn't know. I mean, I never knew what was going to be a hit record. I don't have those kind of tastes. And when we made the first album, we went right on the road, and every album we made after that, I don't think there was more than 2 or 3 weeks between the finishing of the album and getting back on the bus. And when the album was released, we might have like a week or two before the album was actually released to get everything together, but then we were gone. And I wasn't the kind of person who was going to check up on the record company from the road, you know, from Des Moines, Iowa, by phone every day. Because what was I going to tell them? Oh, you should do this, you should do that. I had no idea what went into promoting a record or marketing a band. I mean, all I knew was to go on stage and do the best I could.
Great.
I figured if I did a great show, I did my job. So it was they were the geniuses, I was the workhorse.
Well, not a bad gig, I suppose. Does it feel, kind of a silly question, but does it feel like very long ago, or does it feel just like yesterday?
No, it all is blended into one thing, really. I remember a lot of what happened, and On the other hand, I feel like I've been down 40 miles of bad road and back about 1,000 times, too. So it's all your own life. I don't sit back and analyze it, and it doesn't feel that long ago that we were just starting out either. It's just a blur, kind of.
But a happy blur, I'm sure. So back to bar bands. Today, yesterday, history, favorite bar bands. If you could pick the rest of this special show on bar bands, and you could pick a few that were going to be joining you in the lineup, you know, the rock and roll heaven of bar bands. But even today, who'd you have?
You mean bar bands, huh?
Yeah, or bands that damn well should be playing in bars and never, you know, that something else happened, or they got too big and they should have stayed in the bars because, you know, leaving the bars screwed up the rest.
Well, one of my favorite, I mean, it's going to sound...